From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now! Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld is charged with authorizing torture again. We'll get the latest. Then the New York State Senate votes not to allow undocumented immigrants to obtain driver's licenses. And tomorrow marks the first anniversary of the death of indie media journalist Brad Will in Oaxaca. To date, no one has been held accountable. All that and more coming up. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Juan Gonzalez, filling in for Amy Goodman. The death toll in Southern California's wildfires has hit 7 as evacuees begin returning to their homes. Late Thursday, border agents found the remains of 4 people near the Mexican border. The victims are believed to be undocumented workers attempting a dangerous cross-border trek. President Bush briefly toured the region with Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger yesterday and pledged federal assistance to victims affected by the blaze. The fire has destroyed 1,775 homes so far. This is San Diego Mayor Jerry Sanders. The Bush administration has intensified its campaign against Iran with a new round of sanctions against its military and leading companies. On Thursday, the U.S. designated Iran's Revolutionary Guard a proliferator of weapons of mass destruction and its elite Quds force a supporter of terrorism. Sanctions were also imposed on more than 20 firms and individuals. Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson announced the move in Washington. Meanwhile, Democratic lawmakers are questioning whether a nearly $90 million request to fit B-52 bombers with bunker buster bombs is part of preparations for an attack on Iran. Many of Iran's nuclear facilities are believed to be underground. The Bush administration's official request says the bombs are required, quote, in response to an urgent operational need from theater commanders. It gave no further details. Iraqi officials are in the Turkish capital of Ankara today to stave off a threatened invasion aimed at thwarting Kurdish rebels. Turkey has held back from a full-scale incursion but has bombed northern Iraqi areas. This is an unidentified resident of the Kurdish village of Kashin. We're having some problems with our video. We'll continue with the headlines. In the Netherlands, hundreds of people gathered outside a NATO summit Thursday to protest the occupation of Afghanistan. The demonstrators took part in a mock death action outside the hotel where NATO military officials are meeting. The 6th anniversary of the U.S.-led invasion of Afghanistan passed earlier this month. Tens of thousands are expected to turn out in 11 cities across the United States Saturday for a national mobilization against the war in Iraq. Organizers of United for Peace and Justice have dubbed it Fallout Against the War. Newly disclosed court documents reveal an innocent Egyptian national falsely confessed to a crime after FBI agents threatened to torture his family. Abdallah Higazi was jailed for a month as a suspected accomplice to the 9/11 attacks. FBI agents wanted him to admit to having a special pilot's radio near the World Trade Center on 9/11. An interrogator told him his family would face torture and hell if he didn't confess. Higazi later said, quote, I knew I couldn't prove my innocence, and I knew my family was in danger. If I say this device is mine, I'm screwed, and my family is going to be safe. If I say this device is not mine, I'm screwed, and my family's in danger. The details were included in an appeals court ruling reinstating Higazi's civil case against the FBI over his mistreatment. But within minutes of that ruling, the court withdrew its opinion and removed Higazi's account of his ordeal. Higazi's interrogator, Michael Templeton, has not contested that the confession was coerced. The oil giant Beyond Petroleum has been ordered to pay a $373 million fine to settle 3 separate charges. 15 people were killed and hundreds were injured in a massive explosion at BP's Texas City refinery in 2005. BP will also pay $20 million for a pipeline spill at an Alaska oil field last year and a record $303 million to settle market price fixing charges from 2004. An Italian court has dismissed the the trial in absentia of the U.S. soldier accused of killing the Italian intelligence agent Nicola Calipari. Mario Lozano allegedly shot Calipari as he escorted the then newly freed Italian journalist Giuliana Sgrena to the airport. Italian ballistics experts have concluded that their car was driving at a normal speed and that U.S. soldiers gave no warnings before opening fire. The Bush administration has refused to hand Lozano over to trial. Lawyers say the court dismissed the case because it agreed with the defense arguments that it did not have jurisdiction. In Israel and the occupied territories, Israeli Defense Minister Ehud Barak has approved new sanctions on the Gaza Strip, including severe disruptions to its power supply. Israel provides 60% of the electricity for Gaza's 1.5 million Palestinians. Israel has argued it's no longer bound by international law governing treatment of occupied populations following its designation of Gaza as a hostile territory last month. Israel says it's taking the steps to counter Palestinian rocket fire. But the Israeli newspaper Haaretz is reporting top Israeli defense officials believe the new measures will actually intensify rocket attacks from Palestinian militants. The power cuts are seen as a way to lay ground for both a major military assault on Gaza, as well as further isolation that limits Israelis' humanitarian obligations. In the Philippines, former President Joseph Estrada has been pardoned following a 6.5-year sentence on corruption charges. Estrada has spent most of that time under house arrest. In environmental news, a new UN report is warning that human abuse of the environment is nearing a point of no return that puts the planet's survival at risk. The fourth Global Environment Outlook, or GEO4, from the United Nations Environment Program is based on the conclusion of nearly 400 scientists. It comes nearly 20 years after the publication of Our Common Future, the UN's first review of the human-impacted climate change. On Capitol Hill, the House has approved a revised measure of a $35 billion expansion to the state children's health insurance program known as SCHIP. President Bush vetoed the first bill earlier this month. The House fell short of the two-thirds needed to override the veto. Democrats had tried to win Republican support by stressing the expanded health care would exclude undocumented immigrants. An American peace activist denied entry into Canada earlier this month has again been detained by Canadian authorities on her first attempt to return. Anne Wright, a retired Army colonel and former diplomat, was scheduled to speak at an anti-war news conference Thursday with Canadian lawmakers in the capital of Ottawa. Wright and the Code Pink co-founder, Medea Benjamin, were denied entry earlier this month after their names appeared on an FBI criminal database that the Canadian government is using at its borders. Wright and Benjamin have 9 convictions between them, all involving civil disobedience while protesting the war in Iraq. And the chair of the Federal Communications Commission is being criticized for announcing a major public input hearing on media consolidation just 5 days before it is set to take place. FCC Chair Kevin Martin is already under scrutiny for backing measures that would eliminate limits on media ownership. Josh Silver, executive director of the watchdog group Free Press, said, quote, "The chairman is ignoring the undeniable evidence that media consolidation has a devastating impact on local news and diversity. He may not want to listen to the countless of Americans who are sick and tired of a broken media system, but they will be heard." And the White House has agreed to share secret documents with Senate Judiciary Committee members over the National Security Agency's domestic surveillance program. The committee has approved a measure that would increase limited oversight of the spying while granting legal immunity to telecommunications companies involved. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now! I'm Juan Gonzalez. U.S. and European human rights groups filed a lawsuit in France today charging former Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld with ordering and authorizing torture. The plaintiffs include the New York-based Center for Constitutional Rights and the Paris-based International Federation of Human Rights. They say Rumsfeld authorized interrogation techniques that led to abuses at U.S.-run prisons in Iraq and Guantanamo. The complaint was filed with Paris prosecutor's office as Rumsfeld arrived in France for a visit. This is the fifth time Rumsfeld has been charged with direct involvement in torture since 9/11. Michael Ratner is the president of the Center for Constitutional Rights. He joins me in our Firehouse studio. Jeanne Sulzer is a French attorney with the International Federation of Human Rights. She joins me on the line from Paris. Welcome to both of you to Democracy Now.
Good morning.
Jean, I'd like to ask with you what happened this morning in France.
Well, the complaint was filed yesterday before the Paris prosecutor around 5 p.m. Paris time. This morning, Rumsfeld was present at the conference where he was scheduled. So what we are waiting now is signs from the prosecutors to know whether an investigation has been opened or not. So what we needed here in France was to make sure that Rumsfeld was actually present on the French territory, which is the case. He's still here in Paris.
And now, was he actually served with any papers there, or what happened when he actually spoke?
Well, actually, the information we have is that the complaint has not been served on him. He's not been yet asked to account for the accusations in the complaint. So as of now, again, we are waiting to see whether the prosecutor is still reviewing the complaint, and hopefully he will not wait too long, because our fears are that Rumsfeld will escape as soon as he can. So now the big issue is the pressure on the prosecutor and, of course, the higher-ups of the French authorities to take a decision on the complaint. But France has a very clear obligation to investigate and prosecute into this case under the Torture Convention, as Rumsfeld is present on the French territory.
But my understanding is the place that he is speaking has a direct connection to the U.S. Embassy, a direct physical connection?
What I can tell you is that he came walking on the sidewalk this morning and went to the conference, and he never reappeared. So there are indications, it's true, that the conference place is actually linked to the U.S. Embassy.
Michael Ratner, this is now the fifth case against Rumsfeld. Could you talk about some of the others and the difference between this particular one and the others that have been filed against him?
Well, hello, John, and congratulations. This was really a great effort by all of us, but I know you in particular, and I'm really excited by it. I mean, the
thank
big
you.
Difference
fingers
here
crossed
with...
Now.
What? I'm sorry, John, what?
I said, thank you, fingers crossed now. I
right.
hope France will take the responsibility to move on.
The big difference with this case and the other cases is Rumsfeld's actually in France. And when an alleged torturer goes into a country, but particularly France, the obligation on the prosecutor to begin an investigation is much stronger than in other cases of so-called universal jurisdiction. We brought two cases in Germany. One of those is still on appeal. There's a case in Argentina, and there's a case in Sweden. I think the point of all of this is to really give Rumsfeld no place to hide. And the French case, really, because he is there, is extraordinary. I mean, that he was, in a sense, Juan, dumb enough to go to France, knowing that they have this kind of jurisdiction, is shocking. And, you know, I think one of the things that people can do right now is to put pressure on the French prosecutor to make sure he opens an investigation. We're going to have that fax number, et cetera, on our website, which the center has a new website now, ccrjustice.org, ccrjustice.org, which in a couple of hours you can go to fax materials. So this is a very, very exciting effort, and I think we're going to really pin Rumsfeld in this. I have a question, Jean. If they somehow don't open the prosecution and he leaves, do they still have an obligation to open the prosecution even after he's gone?
In theory, there is, because what you need is when the complaint is being filed that the alleged person is present on the territory, and he was when the complaint was filed. So yes, but they could of course say that now that he is not present on the territory anymore, there is no jurisdiction. But yes, they should actually the investigation should be opened now. If he escapes today, there's still basis for the French jurisdiction.
And, Michael, what does this particular case charge him with?
Well, he's charged with torture. I mean, he's charged that he basically was both directly involved in torture, which is to say he wrote memos, he set down the Rumsfeld techniques, which are all those techniques we've talked about at Guantanamo and other places of chaining to the floor, stripping, hooding, dogs, etc. So he's charged with the memos, the techniques, and actually personally involvement in torture, in particularly Mohamed El-Khatani's case, who's currently at Guantanamo and who was tortured, as far as we understand, under his direction. We also have in this case, Janis Karpinski, who, as people may remember, was in charge of the prisons in Iraq, was willing to be a witness against Donald Rumsfeld in this case. So it's a very strong case. This is not the evidence here. I don't think there's an issue, Juan. I mean, this guy is a torturer in chief. And the only question is whether the French, with their heavy obligation now to either prosecute or extradite Rumsfeld to a place where he can be prosecuted or should be, will actually comply with the law.
And Jean Sulzer, did his visit to France get much attention beforehand in the press there?
No, it was very confidential. His visit was very confidential. He was invited by Foreign Policy, the newspaper, and it was very confidential. Not many people knew about it. So apparently he did not really want to make a big thing out of his visit. Maybe he was afraid of something happening to him. But I just want to stress what Michael just said. It's an extremely strong case, and legally, there should be absolutely no obstacle for opening an investigation. France has an obligation, and the investigation should be open, and he should be prosecuted. Now, the issue is essentially a political issue now with the French authorities.
John, I have a question. Were you there when he actually showed up at the conference, or others there, and what happened in front?
I wasn't there. I arrived 5 minutes later, but I know that he arrived alone or with just one person walking quietly in the street, which may indicate that he did not know about the complaint, because after that, he actually never really showed up again.
Michael, I'd like to ask you on another issue, the Michael Mukasey nomination. Patrick Leahy, the head of the Judiciary Committee, has said he's going to hold up a vote on him until he adequately answers his position on whether waterboarding is torture, constitutes torture. Your assessment of what's going on there?
Well, you know, what's going on there is, as I said on this program before, is the Democrats have essentially caved in. Finally, Mukasey, when he made an answer to the question of waterboarding, you know, that, well, I'm not sure what the technique is, and then he says, well, you know, I don't really know if it's torture, then yes, I'm against it, which is, you know, a ridiculous comment. And even then, the Democrats, like Leahy, is, you know, then have to say, well, if he's not going to say waterboarding is torture, you know, how can we really go forward? Because that's just too embarrassing for the Democrats. So the question is how he answers that letter. He'll probably evade it much like he did there, which is just to say, I don't really know how it's being done. It's national security, et cetera, which, as I said to you when we started, that's like saying to somebody, well, is crucifixion torture? And then they're saying, well, it depends on how it's done. It's classified. I don't know how it's done. So it's an outrageous thing. And if he's not held up for this, Juan, you have to say, when the New York Times starts saying we have one party in the country, you realize that this sadly may be the case.
All right. Well, I'd like to thank you, Michael Ratner, for being with us, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, and Jean Sulzer, a French attorney with the International Federation of Human Rights, joining us on the phone from Paris. This is Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute.
Father, forgive them, for they don't know right from wrong. The truth is set you free, written down in a song. And the song has the cause of death written in code. The word of God brought to light that'll save your soul. Just so conservatives don't take it to heart. I don't think Bush did it, cause he isn't that smart. He's just a stupid puppet taking orders on his cell phone from the same people that sabotaged Senator Wellstone. The military industry got it popping and locking, looking for a way to justify the Wolfowitz doctrine. And as a matter of fact, Rumsfeld, now that I think back, without 9/11, you couldn't have a war in Iraq or a defense budget of world conquest proportions. Kill freedom of speech and revoke the right to abortion. Tax cut extortion, a blessing to the wealthy and wicked. But you still have to answer to the Armageddon you scripted. Colonialism is sponsored by corporations. That's why Halliburton gets paid to rebuild nations. Tell me the truth. I don't scare into paralysis. I know the CIA saw Bin Laden on dialysis in 98 when he was top 10 for the FBI. Government ties is really why the government lies. Read it yourself instead of asking the government why. Cause then the cause of death will cause the propaganda to die. I see the
world for what it is, beyond the white and the black, the way the government downplays historical facts, cause the United States sponsored the rise of the Third Reich, just like the CIA trained terrorists how to fight, build bombs and sneak box cutters onto a flight. Father, forgive them, for they don't know right from wrong. The truth is set you free, written down in a song, and the song has the cause of death written in code, the word of God brought to light that'll save your soul. Father, forgive them, for they don't know right from wrong. The truth is set you free, written down in a song, and the song has the cause of death written in code, the word of God brought to light that'll save your soul.
This is Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Juan Gonzalez. That was Immortal Techniques, Cause of Death. Here in New York, the state Senate voted Monday to oppose Governor Eliot Spitzer's September 21st decision to allow undocumented immigrants to obtain driver's licenses. The governor noted the high number of accidents caused by uninsured drivers and described the new policy as a public safety measure that makes licenses and insurance available regardless of immigration status. He called it, quote, a common sense change that deals practically with the reality that hundreds of thousands of undocumented immigrants live among us. Immigrant rights and civil liberties groups welcomed the new policy, which reverses former Governor George Pataki's immigrant exclusion policy. But the change continues to face increasing opposition from Republican and some Democratic lawmakers as well as groups opposed to illegal immigration. Republican State Senator James Tedesco calls the policy, quote, unlawful, risky, reckless, and irresponsible. CNN anchor Lou Dobbs has been particularly harsh in his criticism of Governor Spitzer. I want to play excerpts of his recent comments on this issue from his show Lou Dobbs Tonight.
It's hard to imagine what this governor is thinking and how he can even possibly rationalize this in any kind of conscience, talking about it being practical and moral to simply provide those licenses. Where is the practicality? Where is the morality in his obligation to fulfill his responsibilities to citizens of the state of New York and certainly to uphold the law? It is, again, this governor in his early going is demonstrating such absurdity and a disappointing capacity that it's breathtaking.
This done by executive order, that's one of the big sticking points for many people.
Yeah. This is a governor who requires training wheels, and that may be the kindest thing I could say about his position. He may be what he calls a steamroller, but I think he's a weak-kneed, spineless steamroller who is absolutely acting against the interest of his citizens and ignoring the will of New York state citizens. It's absolutely an outrage.
Anchor Lou Dobbs on the driver's license policy change in New York. Eric Schneiderman is a Democratic state senator who supports Governor Spitzer's proposal. He joins me now in the Firehouse studio in New York. We're also joined by Amy Sugimori. She is the executive director of La Fuente, a New York-based labor collaborative that works with immigrant communities directly affected by the new law. Welcome, both of you, to Democracy Now!
Thanks.
Eric, your reaction to some of the Lou Dobbs comments about Governor Spitzer and his policy?
Well, we really stumbled into this vicious national debate, which, with what I thought was a relatively straightforward change in the policies of the DMV. I mean, they've got all their facts wrong. This is not by an executive order. This is a simple administrative change, reversal of a Pataki administration policy. Before 2003, you didn't have to be documented to get a license. There were thousands, hundreds of thousands of people who got licenses, none of them ever implicated in any sort of terrorism or anything. And then Pataki changed the policy, and Spitzer's DMV just changed the policy back. So it didn't seem to be that big a deal to us, but we've stumbled into this vicious national movement of the new nativism that is really seeking to demonize immigrants. And I think that's why there's so much confusion around this, because the actual facts about the driver's license policy and how AAA has told us that it'll make the roads safer. You get unlicensed drivers off the roads. It has tremendous benefits. It'll bring down the insurance rates. We'll know where people live so we can track them. That's all being lost in this really amazingly vicious anti-immigrant demagoguery. And there's a very thin veneer of respectability over the out-and-out racism that underlies it. So I've been shocked to stumble into this on something that I thought was fairly straightforward.
Well, I'd like to ask you about that, because I talked to this week and wrote a column in today's Daily News about the climate that was in Albany this week when the debate occurred.
Monday.
I think it was a five-hour-long debate in the New York State Senate. And some of the senators that I spoke to said that they'd never seen the kind of racial tension and the aggressive anti-immigrant sentiment that they saw that day. Could you talk a little bit about that debate?
Yeah, I think that it really started before that debate. I think that Governor Spitzer has made no secret of his desire to shake things up in Albany and challenge the leadership of the Republicans in the Senate, which is for which I commend him. They have now adopted a posture that whatever he does, they're going to try and take him down. And they saw an opportunity here because the public is so worked up with this, you know, Lou Dobbs gets to a lot of people every night, and there are a lot of demagogues out there who are really, you know, preaching this anti-immigrant stuff. And so the Republicans had invited to their hearings this group of people who you referred to in your column, who are associated with the FAIR, the Federation for American Immigration Reform, who are just out-and-out xenophobes and say things like, you know, Americans have to sleep with pistols by their beds because so many of them have been attacked by illegal immigrants. These people are, you know, this is the worst in the great American tradition of the rough assimilation of immigrants. And the Republicans invited them to a New York State Senate hearing to speak. So the groundwork was laid, and they insist on saying this is about terrorism, equating all of the hardworking immigrants we've got here in our city, who Mayor Bloomberg, among others, has said they're making the city great, equating them with terrorists, equating them with criminals. And the atmosphere was very, very tense. And then some of my colleagues were basically calling them out. And, you know, at one point there's a confrontation. Senator DeFrancisco from upstate confronted Senator Kevin Parker and said, well, are you saying, would it offend you if someone called you a racist? And Senator Parker, to his credit, said, well, if I was a racist and I was saying racist things and I was doing racist things, probably not. But that was that. You never see that kind of debate on the Senate floor.
Amy Sugimori, this obviously is a national issue. There have been these kinds of debates have been held in numerous states. Arnold Schwarzenegger came to office and immediately repealed a license bill there in California. How is this emblematic of what's going on across many of the states in the country?
I mean, I think the unfortunate reality is that we are dealing with a completely dysfunctional immigration system that doesn't work. And that means that we've got millions of people, up to 12 million people, who are living and working in this country who can't get a green card, who can't get a visa, where it's not an option, it's not possible. These are people who are contributing to society, people who are working, who are contributing to the economy. And obviously, it hits a nerve. People are upset about the dysfunction of the immigration system. Some people have chosen to retreat into fear, into discrimination, into distrust. Other folks are just trying to make a living and support their kids and deal with the fact that there's so many barriers to access when you aren't able to get status. And that has turned into something that's so much bigger than what it is. So we get to the point when you're looking about sensible policies at the local level, at the state level. What works for everybody? How do we make sure that folks are able to be tested, licensed, insured? People can drive so they can take their kids to school, so they can go to the hospital, so they can get to work. Instead, it becomes this debate about what's wrong with our immigration system. How do we feel about newcomers? What kind of a country are we? And we can't just get down to business and do things that work for the state. And we see that here in New York. We've seen that in all of the other states that have dealt with this issue. And certainly, we've seen that with the failure of our U.S. Congress to come together and pass any kind of meaningful immigration reform.
But then what do you say to those critics who say, why give an official state license to someone who is in the country illegally? Aren't you sanctioning the continued situation of them being in the country illegally?
I think the question is, what's good public policy? Do we want a system in which people are driving and can't be licensed, can't have insurance, where we don't know how safe our roads are? Do we want a system in which people are pushed into an underground where they can't identify themselves and cooperate with law enforcement? Do we want a situation in which we can't even account for who's here and where people are and that people are not able to just function and engage in day-to-day life? I don't think we want that at the local level. Is it New York State's fault that we have a dysfunctional immigration system? No. Does New York have to deal with the day-to-day reality of what that means? Yes. So I think, you know, that's an important question that we need to answer. Do we want to have good policies, or do we want to stick our heads in the sand and pretend that the problem doesn't exist?
I think, and the fundamental misconception that really on which all this new nativism is based is this absurd notion that we're going to get rid of these 13 million people who are living here. I mean, this is, there's no thoughtful authority who has ever expressed the view that we're going to deport all of them. It'll be the largest roundup and deportation in world history. It's not going to happen. Now, the federal government has to fix the immigration laws. They have to deal with the border. Every proposal for a compromise involves some path to legalization for some undocumented immigrants. While that's going on, we have to deal with the reality that these people are here for a long time. They're not going home if we abuse them, and we take away their driver's license, and we make them afraid to talk to the police so they won't report crimes, and we make them afraid to go to the hospital so they'll be just sick and spreading diseases. The notion that we can abuse them into going back to these countries where you know, they fled poverty, it was a lot worse than what they're experiencing here. They're here to make money for their families. They're not going home. So as state and local officials, we have to deal with that reality. My district in Washington Heights, big immigrant community, absolute worst nightmare. If our local cops and other public safety people have to report immigrants to ICE, every witness to every crime disappears. You know, more troubles on the road with people fleeing accidents. We got to be real about this. And the fundamental misconception is the notion that somehow we're going to get rid of it. I'd love Mr. Dobbs to explain his plan for actually moving all the immigrants out. It's ridiculous. It's not going to happen.
I think it's also just important to focus on what are driver's licenses. Driver's licenses are licenses to drive, and they show that people are who they say they are. They've never been a representation of immigration status. Everybody assumes, of course, you've got a green card, you can get a driver's license. That doesn't seem to be a point of debate. So they're not representations of U.S. citizenship, nor should they be taken to mean anything more than what they are.
I'd like to ask you, Eric Schneiderman, the vote in the Senate was to overturn the governor's new policy, but it did not pass in the assembly.
Right.
Still, there are all of these county clerks who are, in essence, rebelling against the new policy and are threatening to challenge or are trying to challenge it in court. What do you see in terms of how this plays out and to what degree the Republicans in New York State or in other parts of the country are going to use this issue of illegal immigration continually now over the next year in terms of winning political support? Yeah.
Well, I think you have to answer that question on two levels. On the facts, I think the governor's position legally is unassailable. I mean, this is something that all he did was reverse an administrative decision the Pataki administration has made. He clearly has the authority to do it. The clerks have no legal standing to refuse to comply with a sort of an order. If it goes to court, he'll win. But the other part of it is that the Republicans and the national xenophobic movement are going to use this over and over again because they're good at whipping people up into a frenzy. And locally, it feeds into the desire of the Senate Republicans to target the governor because he's their arch foe now. And nationally, it feeds into this this effort to really do... This is the worst kind of conflict you can have in a society where a vulnerable minority group is targeted to be scapegoated for all of the ills of society, and people's insecurity about globalization is all being targeted. I mean, we've seen this before. This time, it's not the Japanese, it's not the Jews, it's not the African Americans, it's undocumented immigrants, and this is the most dangerous thing we can have in our society. The Ku Klux Klan, according to the Anti-Defamation League, was about to go out of business, and they switched to anti-immigrant tactics. Now they're having a recruiting boom. So this has rescued the Ku Klux Klan. This is not this anti-immigrant movement is not a minor matter, and we should not expect it to go away anytime soon.
But in the same vein, there's not a whole lot of other than Governor Spitzer and yourself and a few progressive Democrats. There's not a whole lot of folks, even in the Democratic Party, who are out front in defending these changes in policies and attempting to change the tenor of the kind of debate that's occurring over immigration?
Well, that's why I describe it as a vulnerable minority group. They're not voters. Their political power is limited. So it takes some courage to stand up for them. And the people on the other side are passionate. And, you know, 72% of the people in a poll in New York State said they were opposed to the governor. To his credit, Governor Spitzer is sticking with it. He knows he's right, and he's working to turn people's minds around. It will happen. But this is, it's, you know, it feels like I'm arguing for integration in 1948. I mean, this is, it takes a while for us to win these debates. But Amy and the other people in the Immigrants' Rights Coalition, and a lot of labor, incidentally, are very strong on this. And I think that's an important aspect of the struggle as we go forward, that unlike periods in the past, American labor has really gotten its act together to a great extent as far as immigration is concerned. And that's something that gives us a lot of confidence that we're going to succeed.
Okay, well, I'd like to thank both of you for being with us, Amy Sugimori and Eric Schneiderman, the Democratic New York State Senator, and Amy, the Executive Director of La Fuente, a New York-based immigrant labor collaborative. As we turn now to our next segment, on Saturday, friends and family of the murdered journalist Brad Will are gathering in New York at St. Mark's Church to mark the first anniversary of his death. At the time of his death, Brad Will was covering the popular uprising in Oaxaca, Mexico. In his last dispatch from Oaxaca, the Indy Media reporter wrote about a demonstrator named Alejandro Garcia Hernandez, who was killed on the barricades. Will wrote, quote, "One more death, one more martyr in a dirty war, one more time to cry and hurt, one more time to know power and its ugly head, one more bullet cracks the night." On October 27th of last year, Will died at those same barricades. He had his video camera in his hand. His camera kept recording even after he was shot. Brad Will died as he was being taken to the hospital. He was 36 years old. One day after he was killed, the Mexican daily El Universal published photos of the alleged executioners. They were identified as two members of the local city hall, two municipal police officers, and the former justice of the peace of a nearby town. All of the men had ties to the Oaxacan government led by Ulises Ruiz. Initially, the men were detained, but they were soon let go. Since then, no one has been held accountable for his death or the murder of any other activist killed in Oaxaca last year. Investigative reporter John Ross joins us on the phone from Mexico City. Earlier this year, Ross published a 5,000-word report probing the circumstances of Brad Will's death. It was published in over two dozen alternative news weeklies in this country. John Ross has been covering Mexico for several decades. His latest book is Making Another World Possible, Zapatista Chronicle 2000 to 2006. Welcome to Democracy Now, John.
Hi, how are you doing, Mark?
Well, talk to us about that investigation that you did into Brad Will's death.
Basically, what I did was a recreation of Brad's death and his time in Oaxaca. He had been there for a month. And so we did what we do. We interviewed all the principals. We found out that the police officers, the five plainclothes police officers, there's four shown in the picture and one crouching down behind another, are all identified and working out of the Santa Lucia police station. This didn't happen in Oaxaca City, but right outside of Oaxaca City. And they're at work, and we've not been able to interview them. They've been dodging us for a while. If we take a look at the picture, the person that has the long gun on the extreme right facing us, whose name is Juan Martinez Soriano, otherwise known as the Chapulín, he seems to not be in Oaxaca at this point, but the other police officers are there. The case is in the cold case file. There's no investigation going on at this point. There's no investigation going on both at the local Oaxaca level and at the federal level because this was jumped into the federal system. Both cases are cold. And what's even more, I think, remarkable and and depressing is that, in fact, the government of the United States, the State Department, the U.S. Embassy in Mexico City under the direction of Tony Garza have failed to make any kind of move on this case, find any kind of a pressure to either Felipe Calderon or to Ulises Ruiz, the governor of Oaxaca. And, in fact, if we take a look through the communiques from the embassy, since Brad was killed last October 27th, there is only one op-ed piece that Tony Garza wrote for Milenio, a daily newspaper here, about a month after Brad's death, and that is all that the embassy has done, and they have failed to move on this case. We have a case here where the killers were photographed. Their photographs appeared on every major Mexican newspaper and in newspapers in the north as well. We have a journalist who photographed his own death, who filmed his own death, and yet the embassy has failed to move ahead on any kind of investigation. The investigation at this point, as I say, is in the cold case file.
And this obviously is only a reflection of what has happened in terms of any kind of justice for the abuses that occurred in Oaxaca. Obviously, that whole period of the strike in Oaxaca galvanized many people around the world. What's happened in the aftermath for all the other people who suffered abuse, beatings, or were shot?
Well, we still have no investigation of the 26 people that were killed during that period. No investigation by the Mexican government, federal or local. There have been many investigations made by human rights organizations. I count everything from the OAS to the European Civil Commission that was here. We had Amnesty International, actually Irene Kahn, the Secretary General of Amnesty International, was in Oaxaca, presented their report to the governor, to Ulises Ruiz. Virtually every major human rights organization has visited this case and visited this place, and yet there's no movement on the part of the Mexican government. I in the article that I published in August, I laid out some reasoning behind why that hasn't happened, and I think really it has a whole lot to do with a political arrangement between the party of Felipe Calderon, the National Action Party, and the old ruling party and the party of Ulises Ruiz, the Institutional Revolutionary Party of the PRI, that have struck a deal to pass some legislation. And indeed, if the governor and if local officials were pressed to resolve this case, in fact, the PRI would be disaffected and would not support the legislation that the PAN has been putting forth. That legislation ranges from fiscal reform to actually opening up the National Oil Corporation, Pemex, to private investment. And I'm not alone in thinking that the political deal is what has put this case into the cold case file.
And, John, I'd like to ask you on another matter, the announcement by President Bush of Plan Mexico, a $1.4 billion program supposedly aimed at eradicating drugs. Could you talk about that and its impact on the country?
Well, I would say that, you know, I would say that if Ambassador Tony Garza had put as much energy as he has into promoting Plan Mexico, into coming up with the killers of a U.S. citizen that photographed his own death in Mexico, we might have some resolution here. There's been a kind of full-court press here on the part of the embassy, part of the State Department, and part of the United States government, and part of the government of Felipe Calderon to come together around this Plan Mexico. It's a carbon copy of Plan Colombia without troops on the ground. But that also opens up the question about will there be what we call private security corporations taking over the job of training Mexican drug fighters here. It's interesting to me that there's been one statement after another by both the Calderon government and the U.S. government that, no, we're not going to put any U.S. troops on the ground here. That's a political no-no here. You can't do that. The U.S. has invaded Mexico 8 times, and it's not going to fly. But putting folks like Blackwater on the ground is another question, and it's, I think, important to understand that Blackwater is now 6 miles away from the Mexican border at Potrero, California, setting up a training camp, and has just been awarded a Department of Defense part of a $15 billion Department of Defense drug war grant, which mandates them to train foreign drug fighters and to provide operational and logistical support on the ground. So I think we won't see U.S. troops here on the ground as a result of this agreement. I guess this is not passed by any Congress here. It's in the U.S. Congress, and it's been part of it's been kind of folded into the supplemental appropriation on Iraq and Afghanistan. And if the Democrats would stand up for that supplemental appropriation, we will not see a Plan Mexico because it won't be funded. That it's part of that funding. It is, I think, in the end, what Plan Mexico is a way of bringing Mexican security forces under Washington's control, to fuse the security forces of both countries and place them under Washington's control.
Well, John Ross, I'd like to thank you for being with us, a longtime independent journalist joining us on the line from Mexico City. He's written for decades with clarity and precision on the events in Mexico. This is Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. This is Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Juan Gonzalez. The United Nations revealed this week that 2,000 Iraqis are still fleeing their homes each day because of the continuing violence. The UN Refugee Agency estimates that over 4.4 million Iraqis have been displaced. Some groups put the estimate even higher. More than 2.2 million of the Iraqi refugees are living in Syria and Jordan. The U.S. invasion and occupation of Iraq has created the largest refugee crisis in the Middle East since the creation of Israel in 1948, when more than half the Palestinian population was driven off of their homeland. We end today's show with two peace activists who have spent time in Jordan working with Iraqi refugees. Kathy Kelly is the executive director of Voices for Creative Nonviolence. She's a veteran peace activist and the founder of Voices in the Wilderness. Earlier this year, she also helped organize the Occupation Project to oppose continued funding of the Iraq War. David Smith Ferry is a poet and peace activist. His latest collection of poetry is titled Battlefield Without Borders. Kathy Kelly and David Smith Ferry are in New York as part of a speaking tour. Welcome both of you to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
Thank you, Juan.
Kathy, talk to us about the refugee crisis. Recently, the Syrian government tried to close the border, at least in terms of folks coming in and out of that country. Could you talk to us what's going on with the Iraqi refugees?
Well, certainly people that feel they have no choice but to flee are caught, literally trapped. And I think we can understand why neighboring countries might be saying, look, we didn't start this war. This was a war of choice that the United States waged. And what responsibility do U.S. people have to bear some of the consequence? I think it's understandable, and yet there is a humanitarian catastrophe, and it ought to be labeled as nothing less than that and dealt with by, I believe, the United Nations and other countries. But the United States has a huge responsibility to contribute financial reparation for the suffering caused. And yet we see the United States government repeatedly saying we're not going to engage in negotiation, we're not going to engage in dialogue, and we're not going to help the people who have fled from the crisis that we've caused.
So how are the governments in Jordan, Syria, and other countries, how are they financing whatever work they do with the refugees?
Well, in Jordan, Jordan is an ally of the United States. There has been some aid that has come to the extent that the King of Jordan said that for the first time in 3 years, children, Iraqi children living in Jordan, could start to enter into the school system. There is some UN aid that comes through the United Nations High Commission for Refugees, but there's nothing commensurate to the need. I mean, if we're going to talk about where the financial priorities of the United States government have been, it's been in pouring money into the buildup for war-making, for weapon-making. It's a pittance, according to Dr. Rafiq Shannon of International Organization for Migration, 0.01% of the money spent on the military every day, it's spent for any kind of aid or assistance to refugees. And we were told that as many as 7,000 Iraqis would be admitted into the United States this year. Well, they're certainly not going to meet that goal at the rate that they're going now. We've seen dozens come in weekly, but as you mentioned, 2,000 every day are fleeing from Iraq.
David Smith-Ferrick, talk to us about what you saw when you were there.
Well, we met a wide range of Iraqis, right, from all classes of society, many of them highly trained, highly educated, and in almost every case, very reduced in their circumstances in Jordan as a result of having to flee and leave their livelihood, their homes, their communities. And certainly we met people who have suffered from, you know, from actual missile attacks and roadside bombs. And in every case, you're meeting people whose situation is compounded by psychological trauma, by poverty, by displacement, and the trauma of having to leave everything that's you know, that your life is built upon.
Now, you've produced a book of poetry. The proceeds will go to assist the refugees?
That's right. We've started a program, actually, called the Direct Aid Initiative, and it's very much run by Iraqis on the ground who coordinate the services and identify the most needy medical cases. And all but $2, which covers just the printing of the book, are from the sale of the book, are going to urgent medical needs of Iraqis in Damascus and in Syria.
And the refugees, are they are there attempts to integrate them into the overall society, or are you seeing the rise of huge refugee camps as well throughout the countries there?
Well, you wouldn't speak of camps. There are neighborhoods that are maybe, I guess we'd say, low-income neighborhoods, and people have tried to fit themselves into health care and any kind of education that might be made available. But it's very, very difficult. There's a lot of exclusion. I mean, I see some people coping, and I'm in great admiration. I know one boy who'd been kidnapped, and he was tortured while he was kidnapped. He was hung from a ceiling by an ankle chain, and his tormentors used electric prods. And so he worked himself into the local soccer team, and he said, I lost control over my life completely while I was kidnapped, but I'm in control out on the soccer field. I know young girls who are, they're just ravenous to study English, and that's what they've done for 3 years while they've been excluded from the school system. You see people who are sending their children out to be laborers. And the children are proud, you know, because they're the ones who are bringing some income into the family. So people try to cope. But there's a great deal of frustration and anger and bewilderment. I mean, I suppose it was a matter of pride. One woman said to me, well, we didn't really expect your country to do so much for us because we saw what happened after Hurricane Katrina. And is that how we want to be viewed? I mean, it doesn't help our security to have other people looking at us as though, you know, we're a stingy and a criminal country.
Now, you started the occupation project both with Congress, and now you're talking about expanding it to the presidential occupation project.
Well,
tell our audience what that's about.
Yeah, aspiring presidential candidates need to hear from people who have strong views about the war. I'm sure on October 27th it'll be crucial to have swelling numbers of people in cities all across the country, as will happen. But then, you know, on the following days, I hope people will form affinity groups and decide how it is that they can really be involved in the primary process and go. For instance, we're inviting people to come to Des Moines, Iowa, November 7th and 8th, and go to the offices, to the headquarters, to the campaign events of aspiring presidential candidates and say, we're going to occupy your office until you tell us what's your plan to bring these troops home, bring them home alive, and begin to pay reparations for the suffering we've caused in Iraq, but bring this war to an end.
And what's been the response in Congress to the occupation projects?
Well, I think actually a lot of the staffers in these offices agree with us. And if we begin to sing the names or read the names of people who have been killed, they feel deeply troubled. But they're afraid, they're frightened. I think many feel that they don't want to go up against the major weapon-making corporations, and they don't want to be saddled with what might happen if there is rising violence in Iraq following withdrawal of troops. But pouring more weapons and more ammunition into this very volatile situation can't possibly contribute towards security and peacemaking.
And David, can I ask you in the last moments that we have, if you might be able to read a poem from your book, Battlefield Without Borders?
I'd be glad to. This is a poem about a young man named Mustafa that we know in Iraq who was injured in the first days of the war. He lived in Baghdad, and he was wanting to get information about the invasion as it approached Baghdad. And he went to his television. It didn't work. He went up on the roof to get information, to fix the antenna. And the concussion of a missile threw him off the roof. He said, it felt like the air kicked me. This is called If Irony Were Justice. Somewhere, Mustafa knows, he has a twin brother, an American soldier with wheels for legs, a man who stands for nothing, a man who is no longer a man, who urinates through a tube into a bag, an American digging into the bureaucratic rubble of his government, trying to unearth something human, trying to locate a surgeon's fingers to reset the clock of his life and point him forward. If irony were iron, Mustafa's back would have held when 4 years ago the force of a U.S. missile swept him like a branch from his roof and dropped him two stories below in his garden. If irony were bread, a small round of dough pounded, stretched, flattened, and thrown on a fire, a bowl of hummus dribbled with olive oil, a cool yogurt and cucumber salad, Mustafa would never be hungry here in Amman. For 3 years, he rolled his chair through Baghdad, one more broken body bent to its wheel, and along concrete and barbed wire barriers that lined the green zone, seeking reparation for his injuries. I left no door unknocked, he says. If irony were justice, the U.S. military would have given him more than a letter. Mustafa Samir Hassan was injured when a missile exploded near his home in the Karada neighborhood of Baghdad on April 1, 2003. It would instead have given him anesthesia, scalpels, transfusions, trained fingers, aftercare. Somewhere, Mustafa knows, there is a clinic with doctors who can repair his back, who can reorient his life toward the future. But for now, he is still trying to learn about this war from his television, still climbing a ladder to fix an antenna on his house in Baghdad, still falling like a long-stemmed glass to hard ground.
How long, we've got just a few seconds, how long would the American people, if they've seen what you saw when you traveled there, what do you think would be the reaction in terms of the war?
Well, I think people carry a lot of grief about this war locked up inside of them, and I think that the personal relationships that you can develop with individuals and with their stories would be a source of both strength and motivation for people to really be more active here. That's what I think would happen. One, perhaps people would like to know that I have a website for the book. It's just—it's simply the title of the book, BattlefieldWithoutBorders.org, and people can learn about the book and about the assistance we're providing
and purchase it there. And the proceeds go to help the
Iraqi
refugees.
Right, people like Mustafa, for example. Sure.
Well, I want to thank both of you for being with us, Kathy Kelly, the executive director of Voices for Creative Nonviolence, and David Smith Ferry, a poet and peace activist. His latest collection of poetry is titled Battlefield Without Borders, and that does it for today's program. For a copy of the show, you can go to our website at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdul-Qaddous, Aaron Matei, Nicole Salazar, Anjali Kamat, Jeffrey Hagerman. I'm Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for listening.